Welcome to Securing America, with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, protecting the country seems to be a bigger and bigger project by the day. It is obviously the case that the vulnerable infrastructure of our nation, and by that I mean the critical infrastructure in particular, and the most critical of the critical infrastructure is the electric grid, but up pretty close are things like the Francis Scott Key Bridge that until recently spanned Baltimore Harbor until something happened. What exactly it was that happened is still to be determined, but there are more and more indications that something was seriously wrong here, and not just obviously what happened when a ship called the Dolly, a 1,000-foot-long container vessel, rammed into one of the pylons supporting that bridge. But what preceded that? What should have been known was a problem. Sam Faddis is with us, I'm very pleased to say. Man we turn to in most weeks, but especially in moments like this, where we need his expert analysis and opinion as to what happened in this case, but also more broadly, what is looming in terms of the infrastructure of the United States and the possibility that enemies have been emboldened by what they've seen here if they weren't actually responsible for the destruction of the Scott Key Bridge. Sam, of course, is a career undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, now retired. He is the author of, among other things, Beyond Repair: The Decline and Fall of the CIA. He is also rendering a continuing important public service to the country through his AND magazine platform at substack.com. I strongly encourage you to subscribe to it, as do I. Sam Faddis, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you, sir, for joining us again.
Always good to be here, Frank, even when we have to talk about bad news, which is too often.
It seems like just about every time there's something that has to be discussed that is generally bad. All right, Sam, in your pieces at Substack, you have been warning of problems like this. You've just written a piece that sheds some important light on some of the problems with this vessel. Give us your fill on what we know at this point and what you make of it.
Well, first of all, let me say, I think you set this up exactly right, which is there are the immediate what happened in this case kind of questions. And then there are the what does this tell us generally about how prepared we are to protect critical infrastructure questions. In the immediate case, given that obviously this is preliminary, we're only a matter of days into this, it appears that this particular vessel was experiencing really significant electrical problems at the dock. It was apparently in port for 2 days in Baltimore and never resolved these electrical problems. I mean, electrical problems to the point where it was knocking out power, knocking out propulsion, rendering it incapable of navigating. And without ever having resolved that, and without anybody requiring them to resolve that, they then put to sea to go under this bridge. Should also point out, I mean, this is what we talk about in the article, is the particular type of bridge that the Key Bridge was, I guess, has been demonstrated conclusively to be vulnerable to ship strikes like this. By that, I don't mean abstract engineering studies. I mean, ships have hit bridges like this before, most notably in Tampa about 44 years ago, and taken it down in exactly the same manner. So we have not only the fact that this ship is sitting at dock and having massive problems, and nobody requires it to fix anything, and then it puts to sea, but we have a bridge over an absolutely critical waterway that has been, for at least 44 years, we've known that if one of these ships that goes under this thing every day, dozens of them, hits it, it's going down. And yet, in our entire vast federal bureaucracy that has time to try to police everything else on the planet, nobody has bothered to address that issue. The bridge is not just down in the sense like, okay, the road is obviously gone and that's a big deal. But Baltimore Harbor is closed because the bridge is lying in the channel. And it is a massive port, tens and tens of thousands of people employed there, really critical to our economy. The ripple effects are already catastrophic. And yet for, like I say, at least 44 years, every day ships have gone under there when we've known what the implications would be if one hit. And our entire federal bureaucracy hasn't seemed to lift a finger. Well, not just seemed, hasn't lifted a finger.
There's a lot to unpack there, Sam. The ship had to have been put to sea with the knowledge of the crew that it was not seaworthy, to say nothing of unsafe. Yes. What do we make of that? Whether anybody else was telling them, you need to make sure you have functioning power. What do you make of the fact that the crew itself disregarded the obvious problems?
Well, obviously at this point that, I'm speculating to a certain extent. What I would guess is you got somebody who's telling you you're on the clock, you got cargo and you need to be at sea. And I don't really care that. And from our perspective, from the American perspective, the American people, there's apparently no process by which anybody at any level of government is required to approve this. Like, so that entire decision to just blow off all caution and take this incredibly dangerous step that resulted in catastrophe was apparently made by the ship's captain, and nobody in the entire federal bureaucracy has to approve that decision.
There was a pilot aboard, I think. That guy, I assume it's a guy, presumably would have had an insight into what was going on here, would he not?
Well, I don't know. There should have been two pilots on board, and they work for the state of Maryland, and their job is to keep this thing in the channel, because in the not-so-distant past, ships have run aground coming in and out of Chesapeake Bay. That's a little hard to imagine because, it's not like the channel changes dramatically day to day, but that's whether they had any visibility into that, I don't know. I mean, the Department of Transportation has the charter to ensure that all of this is happening smoothly, but they don't actually appear to have any interface. I mean, Pete Buttigieg has time to lecture us about racist roads and other nonsense and to ride around on electric buses telling us about climate change. But in one of the most critical ports in the country where ships like this are coming and going all day, every day, there doesn't actually appear to be anybody who, from a governmental point of view, that has to say, yeah, this thing is seaworthy. You can take it through this critical waterway under this bridge that if you knock it down will destroy the economy of at least this portion of the nation. Now, we don't have time for that. We've got time for all sorts of other nonsense.
Now, Sam, one other piece of this, and you mentioned that the port has been closed. I understand that there's a national security implication to this as well. I mean, everything you've talked about has national security repercussions, obviously, but that there are several of our vessels we use to resupply the fleet or otherwise get materiel overseas rapidly that are locked in that harbor right about now. This raises a serious question as well. We'll talk about the answer to it on the other side of this short break with Sam Faddis. Stay tuned.
The
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A foreign-owned and operated ship just destroyed an important bridge in Baltimore with devastating impact on its port and people and still cascading disruptions in the U.S. transportation, commercial, and trade sectors. While the official inquiry into what happened has just gotten underway, the huge container vessel in question, known as the Dolly, clearly had myriad electrical and other physical problems and a checkered record of unsafe operations. Whether this disaster proves to have been nothing more than a terrible accident, however, it is already evident that deliberate efforts to disrupt or even take down America's vast critical infrastructure could be easily mounted with potentially catastrophic effects on this country's population, society, and economy. An extremely timely webinar today will examine whether our enemies are poised to exploit such vulnerabilities and whether anything is being done to prevent that. Join us at presentdangerchina.org. This is Frank Affney. Back, and Sam Faddis, praise the Lord, is in the house. We are describing what has happened to the city and port of Baltimore, one of our busiest, most important ports on the East Coast for sure, and how it possibly could have come about unless somebody wanted to do something malevolent. We don't know that just yet. We are looking into it, obviously, as are the federal authorities. But Sam, one of the things that I was struck by is that inside what is now the locked down harbor of Baltimore are several of our most important sea lift assets for the United States Navy. Could you discuss a little bit about what it means that we may have those offline for 4 months or more, depending on what time it takes to clear the harbor?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are a number of vessels that are in there that are our sea lift vessels to deploy troops and materiel in the event of a crisis. They're not going anywhere. It is physically impossible for them to leave. Even before we get to the part of rebuilding the bridge, you have to clear that bridge. Nobody has any idea how long that's going to take. I mean, 6 months, a year, if we're really moving. So those things are offline. Also, keep in mind all those other port facilities that are there that could be used to load materiel in the event of a crisis are also offline. So you have major auto import and export facilities, coal export facilities, grain export facilities, a cruise ship terminal. I mean, there's at least six major marine terminals that are now completely severed from the world until such time as that bridge is lifted.
This brings me, Sam, to the larger question of if, as you say, this port was highly vulnerable. And certainly it was not a secret that, you know, you could take down that bridge with a ship striking one of these pylons. What are the insights, again, whatever turns out to be the case in this particular instance, whether it was surely an accident and the result of a cascading series of stupid decisions, or whether it was an act of violence, deliberate and purposeful and effective, what are we to take away from both the posture of the government and the evident vulnerabilities that at least some of our critical infrastructure has at a moment when, as we talk about most weeks, we are facing, in particular from the Chinese Communist Party, but assorted jihadist groups as well, and perhaps others, the distinct possibility of attacks inside our country.
Well, it tells you that we have this giant bureaucracy that isn't doing its job, isn't remotely doing its job. The vulnerability of this bridge to a ship strike, which is hardly an abstract possibility given that bridges, ships go under it continuously coming and going all day, has 44 years at a minimum before we get to abstract engineering. It's been 44 years since we saw a big ship hit a bridge that's virtually identical and take it down. And yet somewhere in Department of Transportation, Homeland Security, the Coast Guard, nobody has stopped to say, wow, that's a big problem, because it could happen by accident, which right now seems to have been the case, or it could be done deliberately in any number of ways. This 1,000-foot-long ship that left port with major problems, and nobody has to approve that, also has no security presence on it. There's no team of guys with guns on there to control it. There's a couple of pilots who keep it in the channel, don't really steer it, but keep the master who's steering it in the channel. And then there's a crew, which is, for a ship like that, in the current days, about 24 guys who are usually some third country nationals who are just trying to make a living. So it would be child's play to grab a hold of one of these things, hijack these things, potentially hack one of these things. Any kind of mischief, and you take one of the biggest ports in the United States offline with one strike. That's all it took. After all of these years and billions of dollars, that's all it took.
Sam, in your previous life, working for the Central Intelligence Agency, as we've discussed from time to time, in addition to your operations undercover around the world, you spent some time at headquarters worrying about weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and trying to, protect us against that threat. The use of weapons of mass destruction, which in previous conversations you've observed is decidedly a possibility inside the United States, against other assets. Again, let's just say for the purpose of discussion, this was an accident. Mm-hmm. Just give us a flavor, Sam, especially if we've got, by some estimates, tens of thousands of people who look an awful lot like Chinese People's Liberation Army personnel, mm-hmm. or, assorted Sharia supremacist jihadists. What are the chances that among the targets that they may seek, with or without weapons of mass destruction, frankly, is more of our critical infrastructure, say, for example, our electric power grid?
Well, as you and I often, you and I are talking about this, I always end up in this moment where I'm sort of like, it's impossible to put your arms around this problem, because as a practical, real-world, day-to-day matter, we're doing absolutely nothing to protect any of that infrastructure. I mean, your infrastructure, your electrical grid is spread out all over the country and completely unguarded, and the simplest thing in the world to sabotage. I think you and I had a conversation years ago where we were talking about a particular grid in a particular state, and I did some initial study and basically said, I won't write the scenario for taking it down because it's such child's play, and I don't want to write a primer for bad people, so I won't write it. But basically, in a matter of days, you establish we could knock this whole thing down. And we could just walk down the list of everything. Think about that ship with hundreds and hundreds of containers, and these ships come and go all the time. You think anybody has any idea what is in any of those containers? No. I mean, they are offloaded in port, and still we don't know really what's in them. And they came from places like Pakistan and were loaded onto a ship. And now they're rolling down the streets of the United States of America being pulled by a truck. And still nobody knows what's in there.
Right. So it turns out in this event that there was a bunch of toxic waste in some of those.
Could be that. Could be a chemical weapon. Could be a nuclear weapon. Yeah. Straight out of Pakistan and now driven into Bayonne, New Jersey.
Right. So, Sam, last question. As we're addressing all of this, I've been told that the FBI, and you and I have had many conversations about what is up with that organization. But I'm told that at about 6:30 on the morning when this event took place, at 1:30 a.m. or so, the FBI said, "Nothing to see here, folks. We're shutting down our investigation." Is that true? Could that possibly be true? And if so, just 30 seconds on how big a problem is that?
Well, I mean, I've heard the same. I can't confirm it. They probably had a Moms for Liberty event that they had to go.
Oh, that's true.
Had to go break up and didn't have time or resources.
Yeah. I wish that were a joke, but that's not a joke, folks. No. This is what's so frightening is we have seen this organization completely diverted from its counterintelligence mission, which is of the utmost importance at a moment like this, as well as safeguarding these critical infrastructures. Sam Faddis, thanks for joining us. Come back to us next week if you would. God bless you. Be right back. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He is one we have had on the program previously, but not in altogether too long, and it's always a really important privilege to have John Lott Jr. with us. He is the founder and grand poobah of the Crime Prevention Research Center. He has been active for decades as one of the country's preeminent experts on guns and crime and, well, what is now called gun violence. And we're going to talk with him a little bit about all of that in the course of this conversation. And John, I did have one other thing that I wanted to talk to you about besides what we've agreed. So I'll throw that into the mix in a moment. But first, there was a interesting development this week as part of the Biden administration's professed efforts to address gun violence by creating some new national overseer for imposing red flag laws. As I understand it, remind us what red flag laws are and what they entail for legal, honorable, patriotic gun owners, perhaps among others.
Right. Well, they're setting up a bureau in the Department of Justice, National Extreme Risk Protection Orders, and which is also kind of known as red flag laws. They really don't have the authority to set up a new bureau. The Bipartisan Community Safety Act had included grants for that as well as other things, but that's Congress hasn't authorized them to do it. I suppose it's one of these things where the Biden administration goes and does something and people have to take him to court regularly to stop him from doing it. But look, they claim the point of red flag laws is to go and stop dangerous people, either dangerous to themselves or others, from having weapons and trying to save lives. The problem is there's already better laws on the books that deal with this. These are called civil commitment laws. They're already on the books in all 50 states and the federal government. If you think somebody's a danger to themselves or somebody else, you can call up the police. The police come out. If they think there's a reasonable chance, which is like a 20% chance, that it is true that the person's a danger to themselves or others, they can take them in for immediate psychiatric evaluation. If the mental health care professionals there agree that the person is a danger to themselves or others with, you know, a reasonable chance again, then there can be an immediate hearing. And if you can't afford a lawyer, one's provided for you, evidence is provided at that point. And if the judge determines that you are a danger to yourself or others, then the judge has a range of options. He can either say, look, if you voluntarily go and get outpatient treatment, we'll reevaluate you in a week or two. They could take away the person's driver's license if they think they might drive a car through a crowd of people, or they could take away their guns, or in the most extreme case, they can involuntarily commit them. What red flag laws do is they short circuit a lot of those protections that are there. If you simply
protections for the individual, their civil rights, basically.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right. So what you find is that based solely on a written complaint, the judge will make a decision whether to take away somebody's guns. He doesn't talk to the person who made the complaint. He doesn't talk to the person who the complaint is being made about. And there is eventually, within a month, a hearing, but no lawyer is provided for you. If you talk to lawyers, you're talking about something like $10,000 or so cost for a hearing. And, you know, the thing is, I may want to keep my guns, but is it really worth $10,000 to me to be able to do it? And so the vast majority of people, since the only thing that the red flag laws do is take away somebody's guns, most people, the vast majority of people, don't go and spend $10,000 on hiring a lawyer in that case.
And John, how does this work mechanically? When somebody files this complaint, is the individual's first heads up that they are the subject of it, that somebody comes and confiscates their guns? Or
yeah, right. They don't know anything about it until the police show up to take their guns.
With a warrant for the seizure of the guns, presumably. So there's been some process,
right, exactly.
But they've not been read in on it.
Well, I mean, it's right. Well, after the complaint and after the judge, based on that complaint, decides to go forward, he issues a warrant.
Wow. So I guess the thing about this is that it seems like there's a pretty high probability that this could be abused by people who have some kind of vendetta against an individual. It may be a family member. It may be somebody else. No.
Right. Well, in fact, I have a good friend of mine, Andy Pollack, who lost his daughter at the Parkland's school shooting, Meadow. And after that, he left Florida, just in too many memories, and moved to rural Oregon. And at the same time he moved in, there was neighbors who moved in right next door who were from California who really seemed to hate him politically. And among the many things that happened there, they filed an extreme risk protection order. And so he had lost his rights to have a gun. And what happened was when there was eventually a hearing, the judge didn't even require that Andy had to put on his side of the case because the judge said, there's no threat here. Why did you even file this complaint to begin with? You're based even on your own statements. There's no threat here. So why did you file a case? And
so that's the point at which the individual in question, Andy, in this instance, has an opportunity to actually confront the accuser, but that's after the damage has been done.
To go and say that the evidence is incorrect or something, or to try to provide his own side of the case. But he didn't even have to do that because the judge said there's no threat, there's no reason for you to even respond to this. It shouldn't have been granted to begin with.
But it was granted by that same judge, or was it a different judge in this case?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I think
it's just interesting whether the judge would have thought.
Yeah, I don't know.
If he'd actually.
No, but I mean, it's all they do is say there's a threat. Okay. It can be very vague. there. And a judge, maybe out of the preponderance of caution or something, figures somebody wouldn't file this unless they have a reason. Now, the problem is there's no penalty that's imposed upon somebody for making a false complaint there.
Just and, increasing the probability of abuse. Well, now, I want to just commend
was
you. And
disarmed.
Yeah, there you are.
But Andy was disarmed. He lives in rural Oregon, and there are bears and mountain lions. There was a mountain lion that showed up right outside his home. He had his dog with him, and the dog tried to protect him, got into a tussle with the mountain lion, but was badly mauled, had 50 stitches just on its side from fighting with the mountain lion there. Andy was able to escape, but Andy would normally have his handgun with him because of the wild animals that are there. But he didn't have his gun there for protection because it was taken away from him.
Well, and I imagine this is something that is rife. Let me just ask you, excuse me. I want to commend you and Representative Thomas Massie for a very important piece on the unconstitutionality of all of this, especially this idea the federal government's going to get, institutionalizing it in some manner. Appeared in The Federalist recently. I wanted to turn to a related topic with you, and I don't know if you're up to speed on this or not. I hope you are, John, because we really need your help on it. As you may know, at the end of May, the United States is among those who will be, all of the things being equal, agreeing to submit to the authority of the Director General of the World Health Organization for guidance on when one has a public health emergency and what has to be done about it. And the Director General is a fellow by the name of Tedros Ghebreyesus. And as I understand it, he has already identified gun violence as a public health emergency of international concern. I wonder if you would be as troubled by the prospect that this individual might be in a position to say, red flag laws, et cetera, never mind, we're going to go directly to confiscating guns, obviously those that are most readily available, those of legally registered guns. And whether that has constitutional implications that should require us to say under no circumstances will we go there.
Well, I mean, just because the World Health Organization would designate something doesn't mean you can get rid of due process and other things there with regard to individual rights.
It becomes a treaty, my friend. That's the
concern. Yeah, well, even a treaty, I mean,
supreme law of the land.
Right. Well, I mean, a treaty has to be approved by the Senate.
Unless the Senate says it won't take it up, which they did last year. This is a topic for a longer conversation. I don't mean to blindside you about it, but I think, John, the more you look into this, the more you're going to find that it's the worst kind of nightmare of people like you and me who believe very much.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah, well, I mean, given the way the World Health Organization dealt with COVID, I'm sure a lot of people wouldn't want to trust them.
Bing.
With other types of decisions. But
you just broke the code. John, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but this is a topic to which I hope we can return in the near future. I thank you for the really important work you do with the Crime Prevention Research Center. Your articles, your advocacy, your clarity on these matters of, our fundamental rights, including the right to own and bear arms, is absolutely vital. God bless you, my friend. Keep it up and come back to us.
Thanks. Thank you. People can find more at our website at crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. God bless. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A foreign-owned and operated ship just destroyed an important bridge in Baltimore with devastating impact on its port and people and still cascading disruptions in the U.S. transportation, commercial, and trade sectors. While the official inquiry into what happened has just gotten underway, the huge container vessel in question, known as the Dolly, clearly had myriad electrical and other physical problems and a checkered record of unsafe operations. Whether this disaster proves to have been nothing more than a terrible accident, however, it is already evident that deliberate efforts to disrupt or even take down America's vast, critical infrastructure could be easily mounted with potentially catastrophic effects on this country's population, society, and economy. An extremely timely webinar today will examine whether our enemies are poised to exploit such vulnerabilities and whether anything is being done to prevent that. Join us at presentdangerchina.org. This is Frank Affney. We're back. Our duty genius is in the house. George Raceley, our friend and colleague at Conservative HQ, Richard Vigory's wonderful newsletter. I wanted to sort of segue to a different aspect of the problem that we've just been discussing, George, and that is, as a guy who's in the business of free speech, as a guy who has worked both political campaigns that, you know, are rooted in preserving, supporting, defending our Constitution. And as a guy who's worked on both Capitol Hill and in the executive branch in a variety of capacities, you have, I know, a deep appreciation for the importance of, in addition to the Second Amendment, the First Amendment.
Yeah.
This World Health Organization two treaty package is also going after that right, our freedom of speech, because every state party to these accords is going to be obliged to create its own national mechanism for preventing disinformation, misinformation, and malinformation. Which basically means anything that the World Health Organization doesn't want you to know.
Yeah.
Even if it's true, they don't want you to know it. You're not allowed to say it. You're not allowed to have your doctor inform you about it and so on. So George, you just expressed some skepticism about what the Supreme Court is disposed to do and maybe not do about such a clear affront to our Constitution as these accords represent. But talk a little bit about this. It's being called by folks like Mike Benz and Ben Weingarten the censorship industrial complex, where this stands at the moment, and this idea that the WHO might not only enshrine it, but make it mandatory here.
Yeah, well, there's really two parts to this, Frank. One is the existing censorship industrial complex that our own government has constructed, which is now being not necessarily dismantled, but at least attacked with some spotty success by individuals who have suffered deprivation of their First Amendment rights because the government went to individual companies, mostly in the social media sphere, and told them essentially, take this guy's tweet down or take this guy's Facebook post down. So that's one part of it, and that already exists. And so now the question would be,
and again, for the same general purpose, that anything that they found to be inconvenient to their narratives about COVID or about vaccines and so on was not to be distributed on those social media platforms, right?
Yeah, and let's stipulate that the New York Times has no obligation to publish a letter if I write a letter to the editor. But on the other hand, if I write a letter to the editor and they publish it and the government says, hey, we didn't like that, take it down, and they take it down, that is clearly a violation of the First Amendment because, the Constitution says Congress shall make no law, and the courts have determined that that phrase applies to the executive branch as well. So in essence says the government shall make no law. So now we're in the position again of Biden signing these two documents that are purported to be treaties and having a foreigner, a Marxist, who is under the influence of the communist Chinese, tell us, well, George Raisley's column is malinformation, so take it down.
And there will be punishments meted out if people don't conform, including, medical doctors who are going to be told they can't exercise their best medical judgment, let alone their free speech rights. So, George, as a conservative, and I had the privilege of spending a very important hour and a half or so with your boss, Richard Viguerie, recently, talking about the last time, arguably, that the United States government formally, deliberately surrendered our sovereignty in a fight that turned out Richard Viguerie was very much involved in and instrumental in waging, namely the Panama Canal Treaty. Mm-hmm. We found in that moment that there was not only the important exercise of the public sentiment in an informed debate, and that representative government operated, it unfortunately resulted in a one vote margin to get the treaty through. Yeah. But Richard made a point that I thought was very important about this, and I just would like you to comment. He said that the very fact that that was so vigorously fought produced three very important results. Didn't stop the treaty, but it did give birth to the modern conservative movement. It did help with the emergence of a national leader of that movement, Ronald Reagan. And it also created political clout that translated in the next two election cycles to the removal from office of 20 United States senators. This sounds to me like the kind of thing that would argue for us having a similar kind of fight, Panama Canal Treaty 2.0, if you will, about the World Health Organization treaties. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, it's absolutely crucial that that model be followed because, again, what we did, as we talked about a minute ago, was we have people in every town, every precinct, every city, every state fighting this, forming grassroots committees. Basically they ran to the sound of the guns. Nobody told them to do anything. They just did it. And we need people to be equally as motivated in this regard. And
in fact, George, the stakes are even higher. Strategic disaster to turn over the canal, as it turns out, it's warned to the Communist Party of China. Mm-hmm. But your personal freedoms, your personal medical freedoms, among other things, are on the line here. Yep. George, we have to leave it at that. We will be back to you for more, for sure, very soon. In the meantime, thank you for what you do for Conservative HQ and for us at thesovereigntycoalition.org. Go there, folks, and come back to us next time. And until then, go forth and multiply. We're back, and we are visiting for one more block with our friend Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps, retired. Colonel, we were, I think, just discussing the prospects that war might, in fact, be in the offing with the Chinese Communist Party. If anything, it seems more likely by the day, both for the internal reasons and the calculations of what the external opportunities are. One of the things that is another weapon in this war, another weapon, unrestricted warfare technique, if you will, that they have been wielding to bring about our demise without firing a shot, is something that's gotten a lot of attention here in recent days, as I think you know, namely TikTok. And you've spent time in the tech business. You, I think, have a deep understanding of sort of the political warfare acumen and capabilities of the Chinese Communist Party. What do you say to those who argue that, well, this is a free speech issue and America must not do anything to try to constrain America's young people especially, but by some estimates, 173 million of us from using this particular platform?
Well, this is an effort, or it's an opportunity, mechanism by which an enemy can mentally influence a huge chunk of our population and a huge chunk of the younger population in particular, who are going to grow up and be the ones who run the country. And why would anyone allow that? You know, there's obviously, there's been...
Could I just ask you, sir, you said they could. You said can, I think. Oh, yeah. The question is that what they're doing right now?
Oh,
are they,
I think,
in fact,
that
manipulating our young people, among others?
Well, I think that's pretty clear that mm-hmm. is being done. It's obviously, it's sort of tucked into this sort of larger barrage of things like cats and videos of cats and dogs, etc. But within that, some part of that is where you get, let's say, you can insert the message. And if you control what people are hearing, you know, it's not like they're going to think anything different. And it is another early Christmas present for the Chinese. And it's interesting just how much attention is being paid to this now by a lot of people on Capitol Hill. Of course, there's other apps, and there will be other apps, you know, even if they go after this one. But look how hard it's been to do anything about this. The Indians closed TikTok down a few years ago in about 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And here we have this phalanx of lobbyists and lawyers that do the Chinese Communist Party's bidding. But this is a way to shape thinking, to shape people's minds. And any fight is half mental. And it's not a question of hardware or anything else, but if you can get the people to think a certain way, I mean, you don't even need to fight. And this is the tool with which they do it. Yeah. And so,
Colonel,
here we are later.
Let me just ask you on this point. We did a webinar. I can't remember whether you were a contributor to it or not. You've done so many of them. We're so grateful to you for that. This one, like all of them, is available at presentdangerchina.org. And I encourage you folks, if you haven't already done so, to subscribe. Make sure you don't miss a single one of them. But in this particular program that we did about TikTok, Grant, one of the things that came across powerfully to me was this isn't just about, getting their hands on everybody's big data, as they say. It isn't just even about having this highly addictive algorithm that they've used to, you know, get your attention and to be sometimes subliminally sending you messages, but that there's actually a degree of mind control that is operating now. And I keep thinking about, you know, the concerns many of us have about the prospects of a free and fair election. If people are unwittingly being programmed to vote a certain way. Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Manchurian candidates, even a Manchurian president in Joe Biden, but we've got Manchurian voters, I fear. How seriously should we be concerned about that?
Well, you should be very concerned about it. It subverts or perverts the entire notion of a free and fair election. And that's even by international standards. This is something that allows our enemy to put their finger on the scale and really direct the way a huge chunk of the population thinks and votes. And this isn't so you have elections that are not in as they're supposed to be. People look at both sides' arguments and they, this is fair exchange of ideas or competition, and they, whichever side is more persuasive wins. That's the theory. And it's worked pretty well. But here you have something where an outside force actually, you know, has this direct pipe into the thinking of the electorate, into what they hear. And this
getting news from it, no less, as they say.
If you control what people hear, control the news, that what they are taking to be news, which tells them what they use to make their decisions about how they ought to choose a candidate or not choose a candidate, that it's hard to think of just how much worse it can get. And to allow this to happen under some guise of, well, it's just free speech. Well, I've heard that argument. That's the same argument, almost the same argument that people use to cancel people. Well, it's just, yes. It's a commercial interest. It's, but this is a case where, you know, it's really unfortunate to watch an entire nation or a good chunk of itself let itself be hypnotized effectively and go along with it. Yeah. And it's the ideal for the bad guys, because if you can get the other side to think that they're your target, to think they're acting of their own free will and be convinced of that, and to think that they have some constitutional right to this,
more to the point,
that it just gets even better for them. And
better for the bad guys, worse for us, of course, all the way.
Yes.
Colonel, we have to wrap with that. I think this is such an important topic. And I, again, as with everything we do together, I value your insights as well as the courageous way in which you put forward your insights. It's incredibly needed at a moment such as this. And I know you'll keep it up with us, among others, at the Committee on the Present Danger of China, and of course, our Center for Security Policy.org as well. Thank you. Keep it up, my friend, and come back to us again very soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. That until then, you'll go forth and multiply.